75th anniversary of its relationship. The change in Pakistan-US relation can be attributed to a combination of divergent strategic interests, trust issues, regional dynamics, external factors. So it's not one factor, several factors are playing the role. So Pakistan, in the historically, after the independence, Pakistan decided to make the partner and make the partnership with U.S. against the Soviet Union. Pakistan decided to make a part with CETO and CENTO, the defense pact, against the Soviet and communism expansion. So Pakistan, in the history, all the time, more than seven decades, Pakistan unconditionally supported the United States of America. But in the history, when Pakistan needed U.S. in 65 war, in 71 war, and other times, United States didn't come to support Pakistan in all the time. And right now, after Modi's visit to United States of America, both countries, and especially United States of America, where Pakistan in the history unconditionally supported in all the events for United States of America, for its interest in against Soviet Union, in the against China, and even South Asia, and even the Middle East. So after 7 decades, we saw their relations are in the very low positions. And recently, Moody's visited United States of America. This released a joint statement, and again, United States pushed Pakistan, don't use your land against the India, and stop the cross-border terrorism and other factors.
Coming to the second question, periods of military dictatorship in Pakistan led to closer ties with the U.S. Has Washington played a role in the weakening of democracy in Pakistan?
Again, it's a very, very good question. No doubt, Pakistan and U.S. relations, U.S. much focused and much better relation during military era. If we look in the history, in fact, when General Ayub Khan took over the government and imposed the martial law, before Skandar Mirza imposed the martial law, and he self became the president of Pakistan, United States and Pakistan had that time a good relations. And that time, United States used General Yahya Khan, General Ayub Khan against Soviet Union. So, and General Ziaulhaq, when he became the president and he became the head of Institute of head of Pakistan. So again, he needed Pakistan against Soviet. When Soviet entered in Afghanistan, again, this kind of military rule was supported and was helpful for United States of America to fulfill their interest in this region. And after 9/11, again, General Musharraf was the president. Again, United States needed a military ruler in Pakistan, and again, they used in Afghanistan and to support and strengthen military leadership. And if we look in the history, America gave more aid, comparatively civilian eras, more aid to military rulers. And it's much focused on military rulers. So we can say America is responsible directly and indirectly to weaken the democracy in Pakistan. And under the military rule, Pakistan aligned its foreign policy with U.S. interests, particularly in counterterrorism and other regional security issues. The alignment resulted in increased military and financial assistance from the U.S., further strengthening the bilateral ties.
Now, moving on to the next question. Islamabad was an ally of Washington in the so-called war on terror. How did this alliance damage Pakistan?
Oh, your question is a great question. No doubt, the war on terror has had a profound impact on Pakistan. It has damaged the country's economically, socially, and politically. It has also damaged Pakistan's international reputation. The country has paid a heavy price for its alliance with Washington. The war against terrorism has significantly impacted Pakistan economically, and its estimated cost around $126 billion we lost in the term of revenue, damage to infrastructure, and increased security spending. The country's economy has also been hurt by the loss of tourism and investment. The war has led to increased radicalization and violence in Pakistan. There have been numerous terrorist attacks on civilians and military installations. Roughly it's around more than 60,000 people were killed. Right now we are paying this kind of loss. Right now we are facing this kind of terrorism. It's impacts we are facing. This has created a climate of fear and insecurity in the country. Pakistan's reputation has been damaged by the war. The country has been accused of harboring terrorists and of not doing enough to combat extremism.
Now, moving on to a very important question. In the changing world order, Pakistan will have to choose between the US and China. Sir, will Islamabad maintain close ties with Beijing, knowing that Pakistan holds no permanent value for America?
Yes, it is true that the current changing world order is likely to put pressure on Pakistan to choose between the US and China. The US is no longer the sole superpower in the world, and China is rising rapidly. This has led to a shift in the balance of power in the region, and Pakistan is caught in the middle. Pakistan has traditionally been close to the US, but the relationship has been strained recent years, especially after US withdrawal and during when they decide US withdrawal. The US has been critical for Pakistan's support for terrorist groups, and it has also suspended, sometimes reduced aid to Pakistan on several occasions. This has led to some Pakistani commitment. They have raised some questions about commitment with the Pakistan relationship. On the other hand, if we look on China, China, on the other hand, has been a reliable partner for Pakistan. China has provided Pakistan with billions of dollars in loan investments when Pakistan needed. Earlier, I replied to your questions. Pakistan lost around $126 billion in war against terrorism. So this gap filled by China. China announced CPAC and announced $64 billion. In different sectors, in infrastructure, in energy, and other sectors, this thing is helpful for Pakistan to strengthen its economy, its infrastructure, and other things. And it has also a helpful for Pakistan with the nuclear program. This has led to growing relationship between countries, and history proved that China is time-tested and reliable partner than the U.S. It is. We cannot say in the future it is possible that the country will try to maintain close ties with the both the U.S. and China. How it is possible that Pakistan will have to choose between the two countries? If Pakistan does choose China, it will be the sign that the country is no longer willing to be pawn in the US-China rivalry. US-China is a major economic partner for Pakistan. The country is likely to want to maintain close ties with China in order to secure access to China market and investment.
On that note, I would like to thank Assistant Professor of International Relations, Federal Urdu University, Dr. Faisal Javed from Karachi. Thanks for being on the program, sir. Now let's see how people have reacted on social media.
Yasser Khan, a netizen, tweeted, America has welcomed Riek Musharraf, an army dictator in the past, just as they have welcomed almost every dictator from Pakistan. So what are we crying for? It is about personal interests right now. America sees its interest in healthy relations with India. So why are we Pakistanis crying? Nagabhat from India tweeted, regular school shootings, transgender grooming, opioids crisis, support to jihadi groups in Libya, Syria, and Pakistan, support to drug lords in South America, bombing of ancient sites in Vietnam really befits Uncle Sam. Uncle Sam needs to know that it will get as much as it gives. Ali Imran, whose bio says a patriot from Lahore, tweeted, my Pakistan is burning under this current imported fascist and corrupt regime, which is imposed by Pakistani corrupt establishment with the help of Uncle Sam and company. People are suffering from the high inflation, corruption, and fascism.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent here on IRIB English Radio.
Cinema holds the ability to inspire, entertain, and challenge societal norms. Fortunately, a disturbing trend that has infiltrated the Indian film industry in recent years is Islamophobia. Bollywood, as a means of soft power, has become a ground for hateful and anti-Muslim narratives, painting a distorted image of Islam and Muslims.
The Indian film industry, once celebrated for fostering communal harmony and promoting Hindu-Muslim unity, is now complicit in producing films that spread hatred and stereotypes against the Muslims of India. Movies such as Kashmir Files and the recently released The Kerala Story have normalized the vilification of Muslims, portraying them as violent and oppressive. The Kerala Story, premised on the Hindutva conspiracy theory of love jihad, portrays Muslims as declined individuals. The movie falsely claimed conversion of thousands of Hindu women from Kerala to Islam, followed by getting recruited in the terrorist group ISIS. Kashmir Files, that was released in 2022, presents a distorted view of Kashmiri Muslims. Instead of highlighting the struggles of both Muslims and Hindus during the 1990s, when the valley was gripped by violence, the film unjustly portrays Muslims as the culprits, ignoring their efforts to protect the Hindu minority. Bollywood, being used as a soft power with its immense popularity, enabled these narratives to reach millions, influencing public opinion and perpetuating stereotypes. Regrettably, media literacy remains low amongst the masses, making them susceptible to misinformation and false narratives propagated through Bollywood. These films, with their anti-Islam and anti-Muslim language, propagate the notion that Islam is a savage, oppressive, and violent religion, weaving webs of prejudice and division that threaten the very fabric of the multicultural Indian society.
Bollywood's influence in shaping India's national identity and the global community's opinion of India cannot be overstated. However, in recent times, it has become a tool in the hands of organizations covertly designed to create a Hindu-dominated society where Muslims are relegated to the status of second-class citizens.
Over the past decade, Bollywood has become a powerful propaganda machine, spreading misinformation and reinforcing false narratives through movies. These movies are not isolated incidents. They represent a broader trend within Bollywood, where Islamophobic content has become a profitable venture. Financial interests often drive the production of such films, exploiting hate as the currency of choice in today's entertainment industry. An alarming trend is that these films are often exempted from taxes in the states under the ruling BJP party. Generating substantial revenue, it highlights the popularity of hate-centric narratives. The financial interests of the filmmakers seem to align with the propagation of divisive politics, exploiting Islamophobia for monetary and political gains. According to media experts, one of the objectives of the production of such films is to divert people's attention from real issues such as rampant unemployment and economic hardships. Studies have shown that local media play a significant role in promoting these films and changing the country's political discourse. Give time coverage to the recently released Islamophobic films helps the ruling political parties that work in alliance with the media divert the attention from significant issues affecting the lives of the masses. Promoting a distorted version of history, these movies assist in manipulating the common people, fulfilling particular political agendas.
Now, to have more insight on this, we are joined by lawyer and researcher, member of Article 21 Trust Think Tank, Asif Ali Zaidi from New Delhi. Welcome to the program, sir. Let's talk about Bollywood. In what way has Bollywood's portrayal of Islam and the Muslim community evolved over the years? What factors have contributed to the recent surge in Islamophobic narratives?
So thank you so much for having me for this discussion. So if we look back at the history of, you know, Bollywood and Islamic and Muslim portrayals, we have seen, like, post-partitions, we have movies like Mughal-e-Azam and Amar Akbar and Tony and, you know, Barsaat, which echoed the, you know, sense of communal harmony and also the secularism. But again, in such movies, we have, you know, the portrayal of Muslims, you know, were very, like, it was very stereotypical in nature. Like, we, when we see movies like, you know, Amar Akbar and Thoni, Akbar has been shown as a darzi wearing, you know, cap, having a taweez in, you know, in his neck, and his eyes are cold. So this is how, like, Muslims have been portrayed. But yes, they were not communal in nature. But then we have seen movies like post-partition, like post-Babri Masjid demolition. We have movies like Bombay and Mrs. and Mr. Iyer, which showed the complex relation between Hindus and Muslims. Post 9/11, we have seen the global surge in Islamophobia, and Bollywood was, like, was not immune from that. Though there were, like, you know, attempts in terms of the movies like My Name is Khan, where they have the, you know, portrayal of Muslim, and they try to, you know, sympathize with Muslim characters. But still, you know, there has been a continuous surge. And then post 2014, we have movies like Kashmir Files, we have Kerala Story, Panipat, we have Padmavat, which are very Islamophobic in nature. So basically, these movies had, you know, these instances, the hardened instances, had metastasized the Islamophobia. So what the factors with which I really feel could possible to, like, you know, to galvanize this Islamophobia would be, like, socio-political environment of the country, because most of the time we have seen India is marred by communal tension in between Hindus and Muslims. So this could be one of the, like, you know, reasons for that. And again, there, and the another factor could be the, you know, the deep-seated, you know, biases and prejudice within the communities. So this is, again, is one of the factors on which the Islamophobic movies are made. And, you know, third factor could be the political alignment of the filmmakers.
Moving on to the second question. In a heterogeneous society like India, what can be the reason for the production and promotion of Islamophobic films in Bollywood? Do they intersect with political agendas?
Yes, there are, you know, a couple of factors that basically, you know, lead to the Islamophobic content that has been, you know, made by the Bollywood. And yes, there exists, you know, an intersection with the political ideology as well. So, for example, if we look, you know, one of the important factors, that is the political instrumentalization of the movies through the art and media. Because as I have, you know, said in the previous question as well, so of the time in the movies, we have seen, like, the directors and the producers of the particular movie have their aligned, you know, they have aligned to a particular ideology. For example, in the movie Kashmir Files, we have very, like, clearly noted that there has been a misinformation, there has been a, you know, clear distortion of fact and histories, and the movies were, you know, promoted by those in powers. So, for example, Prime Minister Narendra Modi himself has said that, you know, Kashmir Files is basically, you know, uncovers the truth.
Mr. Zaidi, as we have seen, some of these Islamophobic films get endorsed by influential figures. The publicity contribute, film's popularity and financial gains. In addition to that, what impact does it have on a diverse society like India?
Yes. So as I have said earlier, when the Kashmir Files was released, the Prime Minister of the country himself endorsed it, despite knowing the fact that the film lacked the credentials, the film lacked the historical, you know, truth. That is the first thing. Mm-hmm. The second, the very recent film, that is the Kerala Story, which was released again by the Bollywood, which is very Islamophobic in nature, because it claimed that 32,000, you know, girl converted to Islam and joined ISIS. But when the matter approached the Supreme Court of India, they conceded the very fact that not the 32,000, but just three women were converted to Islam. They had traveled to, you know, Middle East to join their husbands with the ISIS. So that is very important. But again, just like Kashmir Files, the Kerala Story was also endorsed by those who are in the power.
There you have it. Lawyer and researcher, member of Article 21 Trust Think Tank, Asif Ali Zaidi from New Delhi. Thank you for being on the program, sir. Let's look at how the social media has covered it.
Nabil, a physician from Saudi Arabia, tweeted, Indian Hindutva parties are on the path of blaming Islamophobia. Not only the film industry, but different IT firms and NGOs are working on the agenda of Hindu promoting. Media should play a role in exposing this Hindutva propaganda. Jenny Taylor, an author, writer, and human rights activist, tweeted, Hate and Islamophobia have been mainstreamed in India, thanks to Bollywood, which has now found a new audience for its hate-filled movies. Under the garb of freedom of speech, Muslims are being typecast to the extent that its fallout is fierce and immediate. Noor, a netizen, tweeted, It will either ban or it will flop. Currently, only dehumanization of Muslims is selling in Bollywood. So everyone's busy selling Islamophobia.
And that was our episode on Pakistan-US relations and Islamophobia, a new norm in the Indian cinema. See you next week.
A diverse range of programs. Youth. Spirituality. Culture. Eastern Tales. Roundtable Discussions. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
As Britain falls deeper into inflation, poverty rates rise, and parents face increasing challenges in supervising youngsters, thus leaving them more prone to sexual and criminal exploitation by gangs. We take a look at some of the World Press and Media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Guardian has covered this story and tells us more. A new opinion poll shows a record number of British youngsters are at risk of becoming exploited by criminal gangs this summer, as the country's cost of living crisis has rendered families unable to afford holiday activities for their children. The grave warning was issued on Sunday, 4th of June, by Barnardos, which is the UK's largest children's charity. It said the opinion poll results showed that 60% of British parents are having a hard time either affording youth clubs, where their children could spend their time during the summer, or taking time off work to go on family outings and holidays over the six-week school break. The charity added this makes the youngsters more prone to exploitation by sexual predators online and criminal gangs on the street. Chief Executive of Barnardos, Lynn Perry, said children are particularly at risk this summer, though our frontline work, we know that the cost of living crisis is increasing the risks of child exploitation. A frontline worker for the charity said, at the moment, the easiest way for young people I support to get extra money is to have a bit of food, hot water, and put the electric on. Is doing drug dealing, as the cost of living crisis continues to push families into poverty. The new revelation came after another survey of 1,191 parents and 729 children aged between the ages of 11 and 17 found that 1 in 10 were worried about encountering criminal gangs in their area over the summer holiday period. Meanwhile, Jess Edwards, the charity's senior policy advisor for childhood harms, said youngsters often do not recognise when they're being exploited, and a seemingly simple offer of gifts, food or drink at a time of need can quickly be leveraged by criminals into a cycle of debt or exploitation. According to the report, the closure of a large number of centres offering free or affordable youth services also plays a part in fostering the crisis. Barnardo said since 2010, 760 youth centres have closed, and real terms expenditure by councils on youth services has fallen by more than 70%. In some areas, such as funding, has been obliterated entirely, with seven councils admitting that no money had been allocated to youth services in 2020-2021 fiscal year. It cited one young person as saying that the issue could be remedied with more youth clubs, adding, "That's what we need. Youth clubs used to be sick, and then one day they disappeared. They just want the kids to be on the street now." According to the British government data, more than 16,000 children face sexual exploitation in England every year, and at least 27,000 are at risk of becoming exploited by organised criminal gangs. However, experts believe that since exploitation is generally hidden, such data reveals only the tip of the iceberg. With thousands more children suffering, Britain's economy is experiencing its worst condition in decades, with inflation soaring and the cost of living crisis weighing further on people's lives. Sky News has also covered the same story and tells us more. Children's charities have warned young people could be left at greater risk from online exploitation as families struggle to afford activities such as days out and holiday clubs this summer. The National Society for Prevention of Cruelty to Children, NSPCC, said the cost of living crisis must not be allowed to fuel another surge in abuse, as happened during the COVID pandemic, while Barnardo's warned, "What starts in the virtual world can quickly move to in-person sexual and criminal exploitation." Barnardo said its polling of parents and carers across Great Britain suggested almost half, or 46%, will struggle to find the money for family holidays and days out this summer. A quarter, or 26%, said they cannot pay for activities like childcare and holiday clubs. And one in five, or 21%, said they will not be able to afford time off their work to spend with their children. In its survey of 729 children aged between the ages of 11 and 17, 71% said they will spend more time online during the holidays than during term time. And 8% said they will meet up with people they have met online this summer. Around 13% said they already communicate with people they have met online but do not know in person. The charity's chief executive, Lynn Perry, said, "While any child can be at risk of exploitation, some are particularly so in the context of families not being able to afford organised and supervised activities." Lynn Perry added, "During the pandemic, we saw a rise in new forms of exploitation of children, with children increasingly being groomed, recruited and exploited over social media, chat rooms and on gaming platforms." She added, "Whilst all children, regardless of age, location or background, can be vulnerable to sexual and criminal exploitation, with many families struggling to afford the basics, let alone activities for their children during the summer holidays, some children are particularly at risk this summer." The Yorkshire Evening Post has also covered this same story and tells us more. New data shows the number of British children in food poverty has nearly doubled in the last year to almost 4 million, ramping up pressure on ministers to expand the provision of free school meals to struggling families. According to the Food Foundation think tank, 1 in 5 or 22% of British households reported skipping meals, going hungry, or not eating for a whole day in January, up from 12% at the equivalent point last year in 2022. The increase in food insecurity comes as separate polling by the foundation showed increased backing for expanding free school meals in England. 8 out of 10 people, or 80% of people polled, said they favoured extending free school meals eligibility to all children in households receiving universal credit, up from 72% in October. The polling suggests public support is as strong in Surrey as it is in deprived northern red wall areas of England, with 82% of people in favour in the south-west Surrey constituency of the Chancellor Jeremy Hunt, and 81% in the Stockton South East constituency of Tory Party Vice Chair Matt Vickers in the northeast of England. The Foundation's Chief Executive, Anna Taylor, said the latest data revealed big holes in the government's safety net, adding, by extending free school meals to more children in England in the next budget, the government could deliver a policy change that is popular with the voters, targeted and timely, and truly delivers on levelling up. After energy costs, the rocketing price of putting a meal on the table is now the biggest single pressure on low-income household budgets in Britain. After sustained price rises over the past year, grocery inflation currently stands at 17.1%, the highest level on record. Free school meals would save parents about £440 a child annually. An estimated 800,000 children in poverty do not qualify for free school meals. To be eligible, households must have an annual income of under £7,400 before benefits and after tax. That threshold has been frozen since 2018, even though prices have risen since then.
Welcome back to Aperture, everyone. First part of the documentary witnessed the rise and fall of gold used as currency throughout human civilization, from first gold coins in Lydia to their dominance of over 1,000 years in the Byzantine Empire. But what role does gold play in the modern international economic arena, and how has it made a comeback after the dollar took over for about half a century?
Under the gold standard, in which money is issued based on the reserved gold, the prices of commodities are more stable, because the government cannot simply issue more money. Also, trade deficits remain under control. Trade deficits under the gold standard refer to the effect of domestic gold transferring over to other countries due to an increase in revenue. If there is less gold, less money is issued. With less money, consumption and income automatically decrease. Export relatively increases, and the country sees a surplus in trade. Under the gold standard, the value of money is very stable, unless the amount of gold drastically increases. However, because of this, the gold era collapsed. The gold standard, in which issued money is tied to gold. When the economy began to grow rapidly, thanks to the Industrial Revolution, the amount of money needed to grow as well. However, because of the limited amount of gold, sufficient amount of money could not be issued. This problem became more evident during World War I. The countries that participated in the war had to issue large sums of money to fund the war. One by one, they began to discard the gold standard.
1929, Black Tuesday.
The gold standard faced another crisis during the Great Depression. As countries began to exchange foreign currency for gold in fear of the never-ending depression, it led to disputes over gold.
As it has endured,
we'll revive and we'll prosper.
In 1933, President Roosevelt nullified the gold standard, and more countries began to discard it. After World War II, the world's gold gathered in the U.S., and the gold standard was gradually disappearing. In 1944, each country's representative gathered in Bretton Woods, USA. 44 countries participated, but it was actually a battle between England and the U.S., and in the end, the U.S. won. Since then, the dollar became the key currency of the world. It was a defining moment for the U.S. as it became the empire of finances. However, during the Vietnam War, the dollar faced a crisis. More money was issued to fund the war, which led to increased prices and deficits. When the value of the dollar plunged, each country began to ask for gold conversion. It was the first crisis that the dollar had faced. In 1971, U.S. President Nixon declared the prohibition of gold conversion. He no longer allowed exchanging dollars for gold. Along with the Nixon shock, the era of gold ended and the Bretton Woods Agreement collapsed. The financial system in use today is the result of the Nixon shock. The U.S. is still home to the largest economy, maintains the dollar as the international currency, and other countries put their destinies in the hands of the dollar. The U.S., which had abandoned gold, now had the power to issue as many dollars as they wanted. The Asian financial crisis in 1997 that drove Hong Kong, Taiwan, and Korea to the edge of a cliff was the result of the U.S. recklessly issuing dollars. The reckless printing of the dollar can threaten any given country. This is all possible because of the absence of gold as a standard. The gold and the dollar, which were linked together at one point, now were on diverging paths. The ups and downs of civilizations and currency have a special relationship. If a strong civilization appears, its currency becomes strong as well, and if the currency value falls, the civilization also wanes. Whether they were coins or paper money, overissuance of money always led to the collapse of an empire.
A powerful government means powerful economy.
The reason why the government is powerful because the economic system is so strong and the people work hard, make money, pay the tax. So the government can get more and more tax, which has a lot of wealth and a lot of spending power, which keeps the government strong, keeps the country or empire strong. But why such system can have a stronger economy compared to others, I think money is a big issue. It's a very important.
Ancient Rome is the representative case where the empire's history followed the ups and downs of currency. Once ancient Rome expanded to the Mediterranean Sea, the circulation range of the currency did as well. The expansion of the local currency led to stronger national power through the acquisition of local resources. Periods of stable prices and a booming economy coincide with the peak of the Roman Empire. In 54 AD, the peaceful reign of the Roman Empire ended under Emperor Nero. Nero reduced the amount of gold used in coins and made thinner, smaller ones. His successors also degraded the coins, and the value of money plunged. The currency system completely collapsed, and the government had to collect taxes through goods and services instead of money. The strong empire had reverted back to the time of the exchange of goods. In 476 AD, the thousand-year-old civilization of the Roman Empire collapsed. Even after the collapse of the Western Roman Empire, the Byzantine Empire continued to flourish and survived for another 1,000 years. The secret to the survival of the Byzantine Empire, despite frequent battles, was the bezant, the Byzantine coin. However, after the Crusades, even the value of the bezant plunged. In 1453, the Byzantine Empire fell when the last bezant was used up. The Byzantine Empire disappeared along with the bezant, and the Ottoman Turks became the rulers of a new empire. The special relationship between the fall of a currency and an empire can also be seen in China. During the Buksong dynasty, people in Sichuan made coins out of iron. At the time, about 20,000 iron coins were needed to buy a roll of fabric. A carriage was needed just to buy a roll of fabric. So in order to solve this problem, the world's first paper money, Gyoja, was invented using iron coins as collateral. However, 100 years later, due to the government's over-issuance of money, the world's first paper money disappeared. Once the currency system collapsed, the Song dynasty lost its military and political power and collapsed under the Mongolian invasion. The Yuan dynasty that watched the Song dynasty's fall issued gyocho, based on silver, and created a stable currency system. However, the problem was the endless wars. Every time it faced financial difficulties, the government overissued gyocho, and the currency system collapsed. Once the currency system collapsed, the Yuan dynasty fell like all other empires. The national crisis shook the trust in currency, and the failure of the currency system led to the collapse of an empire. A strong currency and a strong empire were the two pillars that drove history. New York, USA. The Federal Reserve Bank on Wall Street houses the world's largest gold safe. In the 122 gold safes that are located 24 meters underground is gold that other governments, central banks, and international organizations entrusted. After the gold standard disappeared, gold that lost its place to the dollar disappeared into the dark. Then, what backs the value of currency? It's the world's key currency that is the foundation of international trade and transactions. The source of that power is in national strength. The British pound dominated the world's economy for 100 years. And then the US dollar took over. It was the result of the currency war among nations.
Oftentimes, over time in history, you find that as countries change in their economic power, the UK and then the US, reserve currencies change. But I think we're moving to a world where there's a lot more engines of growth, and it makes sense to have multiple reserve currencies. So this is a function not just of the United States, but really of the changing world economy. But it does mean, though, for the United States, if other currencies are used as reserve holdings, then there will be a relative fall in the demand for the dollar as a foreign exchange reserve holding, and that's worrisome if the U.S. has a lot of debt to sell.
The Byzantine bezant, 700 years. The British pound, 100 years. These are the number of years these key currencies dominated the world. Then how much longer will the dollar rule the world? People's fantasy about the dollar shattered in September 2008. The financial crisis that originated from the U.S. left the world in fear, and people immediately rushed to obtain gold. The moment greed turned to fear, the emperor, sleeping in the dark, awoke from its slumber. After 40 years of sleep, gold has returned. The price of gold rose 22 times in 2010, which is a record within a given year. Now the world is rushing out to buy gold. The central banks of each country bought 216 tons of gold just in the first half of 2011. The price of gold is skyrocketing, and the U.S. and the dollar is plunging endlessly.
Even before the financial crisis, there were trends underway which made it likely that the U.S. would not play as dominant a role in international finance as it has in recent decades. You had the creation of the euro, a currency for a very large economic area, and the euro was beginning to play a larger role. In addition, you've got the emergence of China, already the second largest economy in the world and growing very rapidly, that makes it natural that over time, as Chinese financial markets develop, as they open up their capital markets, that I think we will see the renminbi play a larger role as well.
Just as it defeated England at the Bretton Woods Conference, defeated France via the Nixon shock, put Germany and Japan under control, will the U.S. be able to win the currency war once again?
Well, the United States is now in relative decline to the rest of the world. As you probably know, the 19th century was the century of the U.K. It went into decline during the 20th century, and it's no longer anywhere near the major economy in the world. The 20th century was the century of the U.S. We're now in relative decline, too. The largest creditor nations in the world now are China, Korea, Japan, Hong Kong, Taiwan, Singapore. The assets and the money, the wealth, is in Asia now. The United States is the largest debtor nation, not just the largest debtor nation in the world, we're the largest debtor nation in the history.
Once the U.S., the financial empire built on debt and the power of the dollar, began to shake, the world began to debate about the new key currency. The one that's receiving the most attention is gold, that it has returned after 40 years. Is gold the omnipotent currency that will bring stability back? Or is it just a mirage?
Well, the fundamental dilemma for somebody that's thinking of holding gold is that gold does not produce an income. Now, I mentioned art. Art does not produce an income, but it gives you a mental income. It gives you a psychological income. Common stocks, equities, or bonds, they give you a financial income. Gold doesn't do that. What gold does do is it gives you some security.
So as it stands today, we think gold is undervalued by a pretty good margin. We don't know if 10,000 is the target, but we do think that the difference between $1,500 and $10,000 an ounce represents the degree of inflation, true inflation, that we've seen in the currency. Now, if we were to use the same formula that we used from 1945 to 1971, the price of gold would be $10,000 an ounce.
Gold versus the dollar. The currency war has already begun. Gold is stable, but its production is limited. On the other hand, the dollar, with no restriction in production, has lost its stability. The gold standard was discarded 40 years ago after the Nixon shock. Will the era of gold return?
So I don't see gold coming back anytime soon. But if we had a serious crisis and there was nothing else, people might grab for the gold standard. But remember, the gold standard has many flaws as well.
I do not see gold playing an official part of a formal payment system. It's not convenient to exchange. It's not as stable in value as a basket of national currencies.
I think there's a pretty good chance that the gold standard will come back, although timing is a very difficult thing to try to handicap. It may come as a result of policy, but in practical terms, it's probably going to be the marketplace that drives the gold standard back into widespread acceptance.
The new key currency that will follow the British pound of the 19th century and the dollar of the 20th century. The birth of a new key currency begins from people's trust. In the midst of the world economic crisis, we are at a point where we must decide the future key currency.
Gold actually is not a government decision. We use this as a money. I think gold in the history, it's been chosen by the market. People trust gold. So when the people trust that gold or silver, so the government just use that as a money. If that's the case, I think probably in the future or in the current world, probably we should let the market to choose which one is better solution for our current problem.
No one knows which currency to trust and which currency to choose as the key currency. But even at this moment, gold reflects humans' desire most accurately. A soft, yellow, sparkling piece of metal. It is gold that the universe created. But humans gave it power, honor, and immortality. And the destiny of gold changed. Gold has written history for thousands of years. And humanity abandoned gold 40 years ago. But gold has returned. Will the return of gold be a blessing or a disaster? We stand before gold once again.
Well, with increasing political instability inside the U.S. and with the aftermath of the economic meltdown, perhaps the days of the dollar are in decline. And as history has proven to previous empires, when the dollar is out, U.S. dominance around the world will also fade away. Well, that's a wrap for this week. But join me again here next time on Aperture. Goodbye for now.
Your option, our task. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio. The Limelight.
A record number of people are dying from firearm injuries in the U.S. A new research suggests that shootings are becoming more lethal. American doctors also warn that gun violence across the U.S. is like a disease. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. According to Press TV, Memorial Day weekend in the United States, observed on the last Monday of May, marks the start of the summer season in the country. Beaches and parks flooded with revelers, fever of festivities gripping all, and sun-dry and summertime events galore. However, not even the summertime festivities can escape the looming shadow of what can only be considered a truly American phenomenon, the epidemic of gun violence.